freshman year. It was a lovely place.
Yeah, so well, I don't have to tell it. College humor, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I came from the East. I'm not from Pittsburgh. Yeah. And I just said what you, my reactions were. It's out of a movie. It's not real.
Are we on?
Yes, we're on.
Well, I just said another word about my son-in-law. Yeah. Yeah, he's a choir boy in the Church of England. And he was married as part of a mixed marriage. Our dear friend Shalom Comey was a magistrate, married him. he performed at the ceremony. Well, after they moved to Hartford, they went on a young leadership group trip to Israel. And when he came back, he decided. And Rabbi Harold Silver, who had confirmed Susie here at Rosh Shalom, converted him. The rights. And he has become a chairman of the Solomon Schechter School.
Oh, that's
good. Yes,
that's
in
really Hartford. Quite interesting.
And Susan is very active in the Federation. Federation work. At a recent conference, she told a story of how the young leadership works. She said, I'm not going to make a speech, I'm just going to tell you this story and read this material. She says, because I can testify it works.
How it influenced her life.
Yes, it works. And they're very active in temple and community activities. Have a lovely family. We see them often. They come here for the holidays. We go there.
Lucky.
Yes. And of course, we're lucky to have our grandson and children right around the corner. So we're with them a lot. It's a marvelous relationship. My grandson, my granddaughter, that is the daughter of my son adopted. You certainly consider equally and graduated Vassar last year and is working for the Guggenheim in New York with an art background. She grew up in an art gallery. So family wise we're just delighted. We're very much a part of the Jewish community here.
And that takes us into our next question, which is community involvement.
Yes.
Would you like to?
Well, I've always been a strong supporter of Israel. I mean, I started. I can remember being in a YMHA cabinet drive for Federation, which was an organizer today in 1939. Yes, and. I became chairman of the CRC, Community Relations Council, here in 1970. And chairman for 3 or 4 years. It was those years when there was a lot of turmoil in the community, a lot of revolt, and a lot of feeling that Federation does not speak for us. You know, really. It was part of the thing that was sweeping the country. But having come out of the liberal ranks, I was able to say to these people, look, I'm not going to take this job unless I get your support. And they agreed to, and we never had any problems after that. It was all part of the Vietnam, the aftermath of Vietnam. It spilled over into Jewish community. So it was.
Our next question deals with politics.
Yeah, well, We're in the CRC. You're talking about the Jewish community.
Right.
My role there. Well, I've always been a strong supporter, and I think I've given till it hurts as far as the contribution to the Federation is concerned. And supported almost every Jewish cause that came along. I even have supported the parochial schools, which I philosophically don't agree with, but feel that perhaps we ought to support something that has its own rationale. Guarantee the carrying on, the perpetuation of traditional observances. But in recent years, with the advent of the Begin administration, we never had any problem in this country. We could all support what Israel was doing. We loved it. But it became quickly apparent to me when Begin became president that first it was a PR problem. He was prone to say, oh, we have our friends in the American Congress. And as one who had spent half a lifetime trying to create that influence in terms of electing friends of the Jews in Congress, that was abhorrent to me because I know that's the best way to destroy it. Then, coming in as he did after the failure of the 73 war, I had the feeling that he was dragged screaming and kicking into the Camp David agreement. And I've always had the feeling that if it hadn't been first for Sadat and secondly for Diane, that agreement never would have been signed. And I think he has subverted the agreement insofar as it applied to the West Bank. And I think he has the purpose of taking over the West Bank by osmosis, by these biblical claims of Judea and Samaria, and he's gradually pushing over. And many say, well, they're doing this for a protective purpose, but I am firmly convinced that he has no intention whatsoever of doing anything but taking over the West Bank, and it's contrary to everything I believe in. Number one, it's contrary to the spirit and letter of Camp David, and number two, it's anti-humanitarian, and it's the exploitation of peoples. It's aggrandizement by taking over land, which is simply against the conscience of the world in these days. Britain went down to the Falkland Islands because they to establish and defend the principle that you can't merely take over ground by force. Whether you change the name and call the Falklands the Malvinas, or the way you call West Bank by the name Judea and Samaria, you just can't get away with it, and the world won't let you get away with it. And we'll never have peace in Israel until they dispel this idea, and until we get a change from the Begin administration, or a change in Begin policies. And I said that from the beginning. When I was asked on Ted Koppel's program, I said it. I said I thought the bombing of Beirut was not only an inhumane thing, but it was counterproductive politically, as it has proven to be. Well, at that time, I was the only Jew that I'm afraid that would come out and say that. Since, a good many have joined me. The thing has been a very traumatic experience for me, because there is a conspiracy of silence in the Jewish community. One daren't speak out. But here I can show you a handful of clippings by prominent Jews now. I didn't prepare these for you, I just happen to have them here. By prominent Jews who are saying the same thing. So, I don't think we want to get into the detail on that. But now we have the situation of Lebanon. Well, one can't quarrel with the concept of attacking the invaders of Lebanon, which in fact Israel did do, especially invaders who have amassed munitions and arms with the avowed purpose of destroying Israel. And you can't fault leadership for doing that. But I have a great moral anguish, as do many other Jews, about making 600,000 homeless and killing thousands of, and thousands of uninvolved Lebanese. No, it's not the same as bombing Dresden. We were at war with Germany. But we were not at war with Lebanon. And those people have suffered twice. They've suffered from the PLO, and now they've suffered from Israel. I think there's been overkill there. In any event, I think what's more important is that what Lebanon is all about is not Lebanon, but is the West Bank. And the theory that you have to kill the PLO to chop off the head of the snake, well, there may be some validity to that, but you can't chop off the head of an idea. And that idea still prevails on the West Bank. And after you drive the PLO out, then the test comes. Then will Israel leadership be magnanimous and deal evenly, fairly with the inhabitants of the West Bank? Or will the Judean Sumerians take over? Well, that remains to be seen. Now, if you want to talk about politics, I think I told you how I became a Democrat. I became a Democrat because I was one of the undertrodden to whom the Democrats appealed. And as time went on, of course, Roosevelt was in there through a fourth election in about 13 years, followed by Truman, whom I also supported. I didn't really have the time and money and to be able to get into politics until the first Stevenson campaign in 52. And he appealed so much to us with his intelligence and humor and the policies and what he stood for, which were essentially a continuation of New Deal policies brought up to present day needs, to contemporary needs at that time. And I supported him twice. But my real involvement started in 1960. With Hubert Humphrey, really, who, through my involvement with Americans for Democratic Action, and I became chapter chairman there in 1960, I become quite close with Humphrey and supported him. And after the after the primary, I was asked by Arthur Schlesinger, who was a colleague in ADA, to carry the ball and to try to get the ADA endorsement for Kennedy, whom he was trying to deliver ADA, and I helped him. Of course, we've been close friends ever since. And I spent time with JFK on a number of occasions. I got some nice letters and pictures. And got to
meet. What did you think about it?
I thought he was great. I thought I supported his policies. And Sam Beer, professor at Harvard, who was also in that campaign, said about that campaign, he said, you know, he said, that's one of the ways to govern, a personal attachment between the electorate and the president. And that's the last time we've had it. You see, a personal attachment to the president. Well, that year, Milt Schaap came to town. It was the first time he surfaced, and I recognized him as a classmate of my wife's and mine. It was Milton Shapiro from Cleveland Heights High School. And he was chairman of businessmen for Kennedy. He was just a businessman then, But he had political ambitions, and he asked me to head up Businessmen for Kennedy in the western part of the state, and of course I did, and I was Milt's guest at the inauguration in Washington in 61,
the great snowstorm. We had great fun.
And through the 60s, I supported Chap when he ran, you know, for the governorship. And in 62, I supported Joe Clark and helped run that campaign. And in 64, for Lyndon Johnson, I was in a fundraising or, you know, management role of one kind and another. In 66, Chap for governor. And in 67, I became national treasurer of ADA under Professor Galbraith, Ken Galbraith. And since then, I've been one of his disciples. He's one of the great men I met, and intellectually stimulating, original. And he taught me always look down the road, be one step ahead, look at what's coming. And I've tried to do that. And I think I've even done it in the case of Israel. I've been unpopular with the stands I've taken. We were among the first, for instance, to say recognize Red China, and the press wrote an editorial about the naive liberals recognizing Red China. And we were the first to be against the Vietnam War early in the 60s under Galbraith's leadership in Schlesinger. And we were the first to get somebody to run against Johnson. I remember Arthur Schlesinger coming here in 1967. We went to see Matthew Ridgway here because he had been anti-Vietnam. He didn't want to take an open position, but he hardly approved of what we were doing. And our leadership must have spoken to six or eight candidates before they could get McCarthy to agree to run against Johnson, the incumbent president. We never seriously expected to unseat Johnson. It was a way of protesting. One never ran against one known president in the party. And so early in 69, no, I'm sorry, early in 68, when just before New Hampshire, at a ADA convention, you know, I was part of the fight to get the nomination, the endorsement for McCarthy, and that split that organization right down the middle. The steelworkers, whom I had been successful in getting back into our camp and helping finance ADA, threatened they would drop out if we endorsed McCarthy, and as treasurer of the organization, I said, no, there's nothing worse than a reformed drunk, and that's me, because I've been against this. But I tell you now that I believe that if we don't endorse McCarthy in opposition to the war, that this organization will be destroyed. Well, we did endorse McCarthy. We did lose the steelworkers. And amazingly, we got support from Wall Street, from wealthy businessmen who thought that we were right and offered to step in and make good what we lost from the unions and labor. That was a heady time for us working with Schlesinger and Galbraith and even Walter Lippmann on one occasion. And we came pretty close to winning in New Hampshire, and the polls showed McCarthy winning in Wisconsin, so Johnson suddenly developed health problems, and on March 31st, 1968, declared that he would not be a candidate for re-election. We had won. We had actually a small group of liberals who were against the war, and we've been we started in 63, perhaps 64. To oppose Vietnam, and we were thought of as cranks. And here in 68, a small group, ever growing, we unseated a president. Yes. Because a feeling is out there among the people, just as a feeling is among the anti-freeze, the anti-nuclear freeze people. The same kind of thing. And we're going to do it again. We're turning this president around. You see, when there's somebody at the head of it to organize it, then the mood has to be there among the people, as it was after the Tet Offensive and after the great failures of our policy. It was perceived generally. Then a small leadership can make it happen.
An intelligent leadership.
Yes, who has, and this may sound smug, but, you know, who were right in their perception all this time. When the general opinion begins to catch up with them, then you can do it.
It's powerful.
Yes, but you've got to have somebody out there dedicated. And, you know, and we had top-notch people. We had the Galbraith. And we had Hans Morgenthau, and we had many of the great intellectuals who were saying that, you know, and being derided by the Rostows.
Who have we today?
Well, really, you've got a very popular political character. You've got Ted Kennedy together with Mark Hatfield in the Republican Party, so it's a bipartisan thing. Who are leading it. And of course, you've for a long time had strong anti-nuclear leadership. You've had Americans for SALT, you know, people who were trying to pass SALT. Unfortunately, Carter wasn't strong enough and let Brzezinski follow the thing up. So we didn't get that legislation passed under Carter. We had to start all over again with the president who doesn't want it. This fear of being forced to the fire, and there are negotiations going on right now. And I can tell you parenthetically that in this recent attack on Lebanon, with the Syrians being destroyed and the Soviets' other client, the PLO, being destroyed, you hear hardly a word from the Soviets. And why? There is a parallel between SALT I, when we started to bomb North Vietnam. But that didn't keep the Soviets from sitting down and negotiating SALT I. They didn't believe in linkage. They said, that's the most important thing in the world, you've got to do it. And just recently, we started negotiations in Geneva on SALT II, really SALT III. And the Soviets are not making a fuss because they don't want to get out of negotiations. They've got to get their priorities right. There is no linkage. They're taking a terrible beating. They're being discredited in the Middle East and all over through the Third World because of their failure to come to the support of Syria and the PLO. But that's why they're doing it, you see. The same reason that they didn't make warlike moves when we went into North Vietnam, bombed North Vietnam. So, again, there's a little too much I told you so in all this. Monologue, but really, I'm. You can document it. Mm-hmm. You can document it, and I see it written now. I see people pointing it out. But we who have been in the fight, you know, against nuclear weapons for a long time, know what Soviet policy is. We've talked to them about it, and they'll do what's good for the Soviets. What's good for the Soviets is happens to be good for both of us, and that is the elimination of nuclear war by accident or by any other reason. So these are a lot of interesting things going on right now. And again, a minority is leading a movement to change the course of the program. It happens. You get licked a lot of the time, but you win some important victories. Well, to go back to...
Had victories. The anti-nuclear movement has had victories now.
That's right.
Already.
That's right. To go back to 68, that was a really traumatic year. First, it was upsetting the president, and it looked like we were on the way. Then, really, most of us in the McCarthy movement never saw him as a viable candidate for president. But we saw Humphrey stepping in, and we were really Humphrey people. Humphrey was one of the founders of ADA, and we loved him.
I had a close family connection with him. He used to stay at our house. There are a lot of people in this town that remember meeting Hubert at our house at parties. He'd be up to all hours. He'd stay and answer questions as long as everybody asked. So Bob Kennedy got in the race, and there was that horrible thing of his being killed. And then there was the McCarthyites, who felt so strongly about Hubert being attached to Johnson and his refusal to separate himself, that they were slow in getting into the Humphrey camp. And I can tell you that he was here at a meeting at the William Penn in September of 1968. He addressed the student group and he addressed labor group. The labor thing went fine. The student group, he didn't do so well. Well, we met in his suite afterwards. There were just a few of us. Joe Barr and myself and a couple of others. I said to Hubert, he said, how did it go? I said, not so good with the students. He said, oh, there's only one issue in this campaign. Is that right? And I said, as far as they're concerned, there is. And I said, if you don't come out for Stop the Bombing, I said, we're going to blow this thing. We're going to lose this election. And Joe Barr was tugging his sleeve on the other side. He says, if you do, he says, the Democrats will walk away from you. And then all there, he didn't answer. Well, about a month later, about mid-October, he made exactly that statement. He decried the bombing in North Vietnam. That was the issue. And he began to shoot up vertically in the polls. But there wasn't enough time. It was too late. It was too late. And then, so we got Nixon. And, you know, I'm a little bitter about the McCarthy people that should have supported him and didn't. But I'm even more bitter at those who criticized the McCarthy movement, because where were they all that time? Defending the Vietnam movement, you know, the war. So there was fault on both sides. But it was a traumatic year, not only in losing to Nixon. It was a great, not a great noir in Democratic politics. But because it set us against each other, people who had been lifelong cohorts, you know, fighting side by side and for unpopular causes, makes you fellows in arms, you know, and there was a great rapport, and it was just split, you know, the labor people moving out and a lot of other liberals moving out, and it took many years to patch that up, many years. Then, of course, the Nixon years, they were the dark Middle Ages, although I must say that he did all the things that we've been advocating. You know, he recognizing Red China and detente with the Soviet Union. That's something only a Republican could have done. And I'm sure it was Kissinger policy. Kissinger rewrote American history for that period. But there were great things to do. But I don't need to say much about Nixon. Some of our sad chapters.
How do you feel Nixon was in relation to Israel? Do you feel he was truly a friend to Israel?
Well, friend is a funny word in that context. He saw the necessity of Israel. He saw them as an ally in the Mideast. Of course, it was always a politically viable thing to do here, because Jews do, in fact, as Begin so foolishly said, have many friends in the Congress. And, you know, I might say at this point that, you know, all these years that I was working in politics, we knew where people stood on Israel, and they understood why we were backing them, that we wanted friends. I'll never forget, I brought Galbraith here to raise money for Milt Schaff in 1966. And we had a very successful evening with an all-Jewish crowd. He said, you know, if my Scotch forebears were here, they would turn in their graves about money being given to politicians. And we discussed why Jews give money. Well, of course, we have that great self-interest. You know, and we know the importance of having a friendly Congress. It isn't only that we give money, but we give of ourselves. And we vote, and we're politically conscious.